Hello and welcome to the Euromoney Conference's online podcast for the week of 14th of May 2014. This is podcast number, episode number 9, and today for the first time we have two separate interviews, both related to the Middle East. The first, we'll have a chat in a minute between myself, Chris Innes-Hopkins from the Saudi-British Joint Business Council, and our new content director, Giada Vaselli, to talk about the relationship between the UK and Saudi Arabia. And then we'll follow up with a hot-off-the-press interview with Angus Blair from Signet about Egypt. Angus happened to be in our office this morning, so I grabbed him for 15 minutes to talk about the election and what's going on. So, first of all, let's talk to Chris and Giada. We're joined today by Chris Innes-Hopkins, late of the Foreign and Commonwealth Office, and now the the CEO, Chris, or the Secretary General? What's your title?
I'm the UK Executive Director and effectively the CEO
of the Saudi-British Joint Business Council. We're going to talk a little bit about the upcoming Euromoney Saudi-UK Investment Forum, which is on the 20th of May here in London. The SBJBC is a partner of ours on that forum. So let's start just, Chris, by if you could give us a little overview of the Saudi-British Joint Business Council, what it is, why it is, and you know what's changed recently.
Okay, Richard. Good to talk this morning. As you said, I've recently moved on from the diplomatic service. So my last posting was Director of UK Trade and Investment in Saudi Arabia, and I've now moved to the private sector and have been asked to basically run the secretariat of the Saudi-British Joint Business Council, which has been around for 10 or 12 years as a council, but has never really had a secretariat at the UK end. So we've set up shop at British Expertise, which is a leading trade association, and we are. Can you still hear me?
Yeah, we can still hear you. Is British Expertise what used to have that wonderful name, British Invisibles?
No, British Invisibles is actually now the City UK, so that is the Financial Services Trade Association.
The council, the SBJBC. What the purpose of it is what exactly?
The key thing is the business to business relationship between Saudi Arabia and the UK. We have good machinery at the governmental level, but increasingly the trade and investment relationship needs to be business to business. So we have an eminent board at both ends of leading Saudi and British companies. It's very much a joint council because there is a parallel organisation in Riyadh run by the Council of Saudi Chambers. Our chairperson at this end is Baroness Simons, who is a former Labour Trade Minister and Foreign Office Minister, and we have David Wootton. So David Wootton, a former Lord Mayor of London, is now our Vice Chair. So we have, as I say, an eminent membership. Our challenge is to make things happen in between, the 6 monthly board meetings we have.
And what sort of things would you like to happen?
I think we want to act as a bridge to expertise and knowledge transfer, very much in a two-way street. Let me give you an example. Saudis are very interested in what we're doing here to help business startups. This is a key area in Saudi Arabia to get more people into the private sector. Graduate unemployment is an issue. And some of the Saudis who are coming across next week, we have arranged a visit to Tech City to see, how that has come about as a natural cluster of entrepreneurs, and what role, if any, anything government has played in that. So that's an example. We provide a bridge, and we have five working groups set up now, one on education, one on healthcare, one on SME cooperation, one on public-private partnerships, and the other on offset. They will all be meeting jointly on the 11th of June, very soon.
Yeah. I'm not going to go into the arcane question, which is you know, what the exclamation mark is offset. For anyone listening to this podcast who is interested in offset, all one of you, no doubt, there is a session which I'm moderating at the conference all about offset. Which is going to be interesting because it's not a subject I understand at all. But, you know, Chris, I confess to a level of cynicism about, you know, cross-border councils and cooperative entities, because usually they're full of lovely platitudes and declarations of friendship and hospitality, which is marvellous, and, you know, quite a few nice lunches for the council members. But they never really produce, or not all of them, but you know, if you ask to sort of look at a tangible result of these things, often councils are really rather like government committees in the sense that they spawn more councils and more committees and don't really produce anything. How are you going to address that? Because I mean, I think there are some issues for business both in the Kingdom and here in the UK. That are important. Do you view yourself as an advocacy group to lobby government on both sides on behalf of your members, or are you looking for something perhaps more practical in terms of, you know, a noticeable increase in the flows of capital between both countries?
Yeah, no, good question. I think the bottom line is how we can help introduce new companies to the market in either direction. And in fact, we've just concluded an agreement with UK Trade and Investment, who would like to use the Business Council as a means to help particularly UK SMEs into the Saudi market. It is a challenging market. There are no quick wins. It's all about relationships and building up that relationship over a couple of years, often, which results in the business. And it is increasingly a more sophisticated market. It's not just a market that you sell to. It is very much more about joint ventures and technology transfer. So I think our job is to educate companies as to the possibilities, but also, as you say, to lobby discreetly on barriers to trade as we see them. And in fact, some of the barriers to trade I think are shared by our Saudi counterparts. You know, there is a bureaucratic challenge in setting up a company in Saudi Arabia. I think SAGIA, the investment authority, are aware of that, and we need to work with them on how to get companies onto a faster track to get up and running and create the jobs that, you know, we all need.
Hi, Chris. This is Giada Vercelli. I'm also with Euromoney Conferences. I was lucky enough to be in Riyadh last week and I had a conversation with a CEO for Cisco Saudi Arabia, who seemed to be very much up to speed in terms of transfer of know-how, meaning that the company itself was organizing training schemes for young engineers. So my question to you is, why should an entrepreneur come and report towards the authorities and the government rather than going on the private sector directly, when they're already so active in this sense?
Well, I think companies setting up in Saudi Arabia need to be aware of the governmental priorities. And as you've said, Cisco and others need to be aware of the Saudiization challenge, i.e. what can a UK or other investor do to help create jobs for young Saudis and transfer skills and technology. So increasingly, SAGIA, I think, is looking at investment applications in these terms. So the more companies can build this into their offer, I think the greater chance they will of succeeding and getting off the ground quickly, and ticking, you know, some of the Saudi government priorities in so doing.
Because I mean, I think picking up on Jada's point, you know, Saudi Arabia is still a country where you need to have, you know, an investment license,
mm-hmm.
you know, which is, you know, not something one needs in the UK. You just come and do it. But the point I really wanted to make is that, of course, the forum that we're running and the work that we do is as much about Saudi outward investment. And of course, the UK is one place where many Saudi entrepreneurs and companies are actually quite heavily invested, and I don't just mean in large houses in the centre of London, but there are some of our hospitals, for example, are owned by Saudi investors. There are technology companies, there are service providers. There's all sorts of different Saudi investment in the country. What role does the council play in looking at the way that the cooperation can come towards the UK as well as towards the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia? Is that your role at all, or is that the other end of the...
Yeah, no, that's absolutely right, Richard. I mean, we are working with UKTI and regional agencies, for example, Manchester, when we brought over the Saudi Minister of Commerce and a very strong business delegation in February. We suggested a trip to Manchester, so we had 40 Saudis on the train to Manchester at 7 o'clock in the morning, including His Royal Highness Prince Mohammed. I'm glad to say the Saudi ambassador joined us. And we had a fantastic day hosted by Manchester City Council, Chamber of Commerce, the Airport City in Manchester. And I think this was a first, and I think a lot of the Saudi embassy people hadn't actually been up there yet. And it showed there were some real investment opportunities there, probably a lower cost base than London. And as you say, things like healthcare, technologies, media, and it's not just about property. This is the challenge, is to diversify the Saudi investment portfolio in the UK beyond real estate. Another opportunity coming up is the big Liverpool Festival of Business in July. I'll be speaking at that. And there is strong Saudi interest there. In fact, the Olian Group, through Peel Holdings, is one of the main sponsors of this, and they are investing in regeneration of the northwest of England through ports and logistics development. That's a good example.
Chris, a couple of years ago, the UK Business Ambassador Network came over to the Chamber of Commerce in Riyadh, because you were mentioning earlier your cooperation with the Chamber of Commerce, in order to establish a relationship for 5 million almost SMEs, UK SMEs. Have you seen any capital flow outward from Saudi Arabia toward the UK in funding young SMEs?
Not significantly yet, but I'm hoping at the conference next week this will be a good talking point, not least because we have the head of TACNIA, a new Saudi technology investment fund, coming, and I know they're very interested in innovative SMEs. When I was in Riyadh late last year, I witnessed the signing of a joint venture between a business startup at this end, and on mobile payments. Again, the Saudis were investing in the technology that they want to apply in order to promote e-commerce and mobile banking payments. That's a good example. So, it's bringing these companies together and perhaps acting as a discreet marriage broker. We can't do the business ourselves.
That's a better business.
We can get people around the table.
Chris, I think we're running out of time, so I just want to say thank you very much for joining us this morning, and I'm very much looking forward to seeing you next week along with nigh on 400 other people at the Saudi UK Investment Forum. which we all intend to be the first Saudi UK of our one, and it is something that we will build on and grow over the coming years. So, Chris, thank you and goodbye.
Thank you very much, Richard, and look forward to a very successful conference next week. And thanks for all your work in that direction.
It's a pleasure.
Thank you, Chris.
I'm joined now by our second guest of the day. By rather a fortuitous coincidence, Angus Blair, known to many of you and CEO and president of the Signet Institute in Cairo, is in fact in London and has popped into the office and is now sitting next to me in person, which is wonderful. Good morning, Angus.
Good morning to you.
So from talking about the British relationship with the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia, we're going to have a little bit of a gear change and talk about Cairo, another place that, or Egypt, that is very close to our hearts here at Euromoney. Angus, just give us a little bit of a two-minute thumbnail on where we are. The elections are next month. They're in June, is that correct?
No, at the end of May.
End of May. But the result is not expected until June.
I think, actually, if the turnout is, as we expect, not that good, I think we'll have the results within a day or so, actually. We'll know by the end of May. The election is 26th and 27th of May.
But, I mean, arguably, we already know what the result's going to be.
Well, technically, Field Marshal al-Sisi is very likely to win, but I think the turnout's going to be quite low. There's a disassociation between the general public and the body politic, and I think many young people particularly will keep away, won't vote. And I think that on the 5th of June we'll have the formal installation and thereafter a cabinet reshuffle under the new administration.
Let's look at that cabinet reshuffle. I mean, there are a number of pivotal economic ministers that you think might change. I mean, finance... We think will stay, but the trade, industry, and investment minister, Walid Fakhri Abdul Nour.
Walid Fakhri Abdul Nour.
Yeah. Do you? I mean, I hesitate to ask you to make specific predictions, but you know, do you think there will be a significant change in the makeup of the cabinet? The prime minister, for example, Mehleb. Do you think he will be retained, or is Sisi going to come in, if he does, of course, and you know, really stamp his own opinion on who should be in the cabinet?
Without doubt, I think Ibrahim Mehleb, the current PM, will stay. He's good, he's energetic, quite dynamic, quite focused. I think we'll have a change of Minister of Industry, who I think has become exhausted by holding three portfolios. I've got the feeling the Minister of Foreign Affairs, Nabil Fahmy, may also leave. There might be other minor reshuffles, but I think some of the other newer ministers who are actually doing a pretty good job, like supply, social solidarity, health, and so on, will probably stay. So we'll see a limited reshuffle, but it might be in some key positions. I think the Minister of Finance will stay. He's good, very, very good, probably the best finance minister Egypt had in over 3 years. Somebody's focused.
And it's had quite a few.
Oh, it has.
And the central bank governor, of course, Hisham Ramiz is into his four-year term, isn't it? So he's got another couple of years to run. But he seems to be pretty well-respected and well-thought.
Well, he's doing a decent job. I have to say his predecessor, he comes after a hard act to follow, Dr. Farouk Al-Oktar, who'd done a tremendous job in restructuring Egypt's banking system following 2004 and the economic crisis Egypt was in then. And in the end result, actually, he put the banking system in an incredibly good shape for ahead of the uprising, which has meant that the banking sector has done pretty well, actually, until now, although it's now a bit saturated with government debt. But Hisham Ramiz is doing a decent job, still trying to institutionalize further the central bank. Has different elements of character to his predecessor, but he's fine. But I think he'll stay for a while.
So, despite all of the political ups and downs of Egypt, the fundamental challenges that the economy faces in terms of subsidies, in terms of particularly energy and food, relatively slow growth or growth that is below the rate of growth in population, unemployment, youth unemployment, the infrastructure deficit, all of these things are still the same as they were 3 years ago, pre-revolution, or arguably they got worse. Do you think that the new president will be able now to start the process of addressing these structural problems properly, or are we still going to be in a place where the can is being kicked down the road?
Yeah, I think the preparatory work has already been done under Hanik Henry Simeon. There's a much better focus, and I think that work will become more intensified following the results of the presidential election, assuming LCC wins, because Sabahi, the other contender, his economic program is really disastrous. Give away assets to people. I think that there'll be, and Hanik Henry Simeon, the Minister of Finance, actually announced that the emphasis this year is on cutting subsidies, because subsidies outside food really benefit the rich. So fuel subsidy particularly will be targeted, and that's a good thing. And setting limits. Already the smart card system has been rolled out very sharply the last few months. Everyone's really got it already or is getting their smart cards now. And the limits will be set. But clearly any form of subsidy is open to abuse, even if there are limits. So I think what we'll find is that as long as the system is up and running, they'll be able to monitor who's buying and who's selling, and then set the limits as quickly as possible in practice. And I think that we should expect that, and I think it's going to be very good. And we'll get, there has to be progress on that, because this year the budget deficit was about 14% the last fiscal year, likely to be about between 13 and 14% this year.
We've seen in the last 48 hours some announcements. Admittedly, I received this not from the companies themselves, but through various official sources in Egypt, of UK companies, coincidentally, upping their investment. BP saying that it would put more investment into the development of natural gas, and Vodafone saying that it would increase its employment and its operations. Do you think that foreign direct investor confidence is returning to Egypt, or are these just opportunistic acts of, you know, market timing?
No, I think one of the misconceptions about Egypt is the economy is a disaster. It's not. It's got immensely difficult structural issues. Some of them are long-standing, including chronic high inflation. But this is an enormously liquid economy. Debt, private sector debt, household debt, is below 10% of GDP, compared to over 100% in the UK, for example. Private sector debt, as in corporate debt, is below 20%, versus, if you really take the UK, could be several hundred percent. So that liquidity help is enormous strength, and it does mean that with a huge grey economy, with remittances coming in to households, Egypt's got a very strong consumer market if you're well positioned. Coca-Cola announced around $500 million of investment. Samsung are adding to their investment in terms of manufacturing, and in fact they've announced only about 2 weeks ago another $40 million for the first research and development centre in the whole of Africa in Egypt. So on top of the news from Vodafone, which is obviously consumer related, of course there is a problem there in remitting their profits back to the UK. So I can understand why they might want to invest more, but clearly there's another issue on top of that, where Telecom Egypt has applied for another mobile license in Egypt, and therefore would have to sell its stake in Vodafone. So clearly there's a repositioning within Vodafone. In terms of the oil and gas sector, it's the crux, because the majority of foreign direct investment into Egypt in the last decade has come from the oil and gas sector. And it's useful, given the news from British Gas of the force majeure and the contract with Egypt, although they're still there and still operating, that BP has announced that they're going to increase production. I think it's good because Egypt needs the gas. The question is, can it pay for it? Of course, the indebtedness to the oil and gas companies is up about $800 million since the end of 2013. And that's why there has to be restructuring of subsidies and focus and cut the wastage and usage generally, so that the companies can be paid and there can be a better flow of capital again into that sector.
Let's close out what we're talking about this morning. Let's look at the markets, the equity market particularly, but also the government debt market. The major issue from a foreign investor point of view has been the remittance of you know, being able to get your profits, get your money out of Egypt over the past 3 or 4 years. Where are we with that? How far along are we to resolving any of those issues? And do you think that it is likely or possible that that sort of freeze on being able to convert foreign currency will convert into foreign currency could come back at any moment?
I think it's going to be removed in stages only. Because I have had discussions with the international financial institutions, and it's quite clear that if you remove capital controls, there'd be a problem of confidence immediately. So they're not going to be removed immediately. They'll be removed in stages. So I think that companies that are in the market and can't take their profits out would find ways, or will have to find ways, to either keep those assets and maybe government debt, or buying some other assets and selling them to try and make some money. Real estate, for example. I've seen some examples of that, but not too much so far.
But I mean, capital controls are a big block to new investment flowing into the equity markets nominally. I mean, if you look at the indices, the Case 30 and all of that, they perform pretty well.
Yeah.
I mean, far better than you would expect given the political volatility. But underlying that is the fact that there's very little new money coming into the market, particularly from Western investors. And, you know, because there is a great, you know, if we put our money in, even though the markets look nice, we might not be able to get it out. So what would have to happen for the free flow of capital to be, you know, how long will it take, do you think, for the free flow of capital to be re-established in Egypt?
A few years.
Very good. Angus, I wish we could talk for more, but we've hit our 30-minute boundary for our podcast, and we'll stick to that. So thank you very much for joining us this morning, particularly in person. It's lovely to see you, and we'll see you very soon. I hope we'll be back in Cairo in September.
Great.